You're listening to the School Marketing Journal podcast. Conversations on the art of leading modern school marketing with Brad Entwistle and Andrew Sculthorpe.
Hello and welcome to this special interview episode of the School Marketing Journal podcast. I'm Brad Entwistle. Thanks for joining us. Our guest today is not a marketer, but his insights into brand and relationships in schools certainly made me sit up and take notice, and I think they will for you too. So, Dr. Rob Lowe, thanks for joining us.
I'm very glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Now, Rob, I should also say welcome to Australia because the accent will give away. You are from the UK, but give us a quick tour of your professional life, how you came to be now in the midst of Melbourne.
Thank you. Yeah, so I was born and brought up in the Midlands of England, but went to Cambridge University in the late 90s to study education policy and English literature. It was a dual honours degree. It was a great degree because I really wanted to be in education. And by the time I'd finished that, in 2001, I was offered a fully funded PhD, which I turned down, much to the horror of the professor in front of me, because I really wanted to be a teacher. And I fundamentally believed, and doesn't want to offend others in saying this, but I really believed myself passionately that you cannot tell teachers how to be teachers unless you have been one. So I stayed in Cambridge. I'd met my wife at university. We got our first teaching jobs. She, a primary school teacher locally. I was a secondary English teacher. Then I was a faculty head of English, assistant principal of a very large college of 1,800 pupils. In fact, actually the first school I worked in was 2,100 pupils. I've only ever worked in really big government schools. So I understand the complexities of large organizations and the challenges of engaging with stakeholders of various different types in an environment like that. But in 2013, actually, it was actually just a little bit before that. It was in the spring of 2012. I went to listen to a really interesting thinker, a guy called Dr. Michael Schluter. And he was talking about how one might rethink public policy, organizational culture and development through a relational lens. And he spoke about some extraordinary prior work in that space. I think the first projects that the then Relationships Foundation, an organization I went on to become the CEO of, were in the context of prisons and justice. We did a project in Scottish prisons in the northwest of Glasgow in the 90s. And we measure the quality of relationships, and we'll go into that later, I'm sure. That's one of the unique things the foundation does. And the thing that Dr. Schluter spoke of most profoundly that evening, the ability to quantify, measure relationships. And we looked at and explore relationships between prisoners and wardens and staff in those prisons. That piece of work is so impactful that my understanding is that it's still the only prison in the United Kingdom where prisoners and staff eat communally safely together every day. That evening, Dr. Schluter spoke about work in peace-building context. Relationships Foundation had worked pre-Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa, post-conflict Rwanda. They'd worked in business context, in the healthcare system. But at the end of that evening, he made a throwaway comment, which was that they'd never done any work in education, never done work in schools, never found anybody to do that for them. And I ran up to him afterwards, and within a year, I'd given up my perfectly secure job without the promise of a first year's salary. And I went on to found what was then called Relational Schools Project. We did an enormous amount of work, you know, in the UK and then across the world globally. Started working with schools in Australia over the last 3 years or so. And it was through that that I had an invitation to come and work for a school group here. So I've recently, very recently in June, emigrated here with my family, and I work 4 days a week with that school group. And then in that fifth day, looking to set up an Asia Pacific Office of Relationships Foundation here. That's the story of how I find myself in Metro Melbourne today.
Well, it's good to have you in the land of Oz, and we welcome you with open arms. But can you give me the 30-second pitch, if you like? What is the basic premise of Relationships Foundation? Why are relationships just so important?
Well, you've really done me there, Brad, because the fact that I have to do that in 30 seconds. So Relationships Foundation was set up 25 years ago to develop relational thinking. Relational thinking is built on this idea that good societies are founded on good relationships from family and to community, to public service, to business. And what we do as a foundation is study the effect that culture, business, government have on relationships, create new ideas, for strengthening social connections. We campaign on issues where relationships are being undermined. And what we try to do first and foremost is research, train, equip people to think relationally for themselves. And there's kind of three key things that sit at the heart of that. So there is a fundamental need to look at the world, we believe, through a different lens, a relational lens. And we appreciate that many people will be unfamiliar with that, but perhaps given this audience, I take it there will be both a greater understanding for and receptiveness to such ideas. I think secondly, it's important to say that we need to think about relationships not as a means to an end, but an end in itself. And I think we're used to the idea, I might suggest, of using relationships to achieve some other purpose, whether it be increased profits or political advancement, whatever that may be. And lastly, and also really crucially, I would suggest that in order to foreground the central importance of relationships, there has been a need for someone, and more people are entering this space, to pioneer the mapping and measurement of them. And I think that's part of making relationships an end goal and very important. So that's the fundamental idea. And it's based on the development of social neuroscience in the last two decades. That has grown since the year 2000. We know more now about the way our brains affect our bodies and our bodies affect our brains than we have ever done. We've always known that relationships are fundamental to personal psychological health, I think. What we were perhaps less familiar with was the driver of physical health as well. And it's only since the work of, you know, Rob Waldinger, the Harvard Longitudinal Study of Adult Development, and the work of Helen Pearson, the work of Susan Pinker, all these key thinkers who've been exploring, yes, societies for the last sort of 50 to 100 years, where we can start to see over cross big, big data sets, the ways in which individuals and groups flourish when they are better connected. So, for example, we know that from studies of utility workers in Central Europe, you can start to predict who's going to be alive at the end of a decade based on who's in relationship at the beginning of it. We know that you know, dementia rates in over 50 men much lower if those males are in a much tighter connected known group of relationships. We know even more fascinating things. So Stephen Cole, UCLA 2004, fabulous study which demonstrated that our relationship quality actually turn off and on our gene responses to certain cancers. We know that face-to-face interaction affects how well we learn to read, how quickly we fight off rudimentary infection, and ultimately, therefore, how long we live. And perhaps the most troubling part of the context we find ourselves in now in COVID-19, that actually tighter social connection becomes the very mechanism of spreading the virus that kills us, and it has become the enemy of it. But prior to this, we've known more now than we've ever done about how important it is to be together more often and not virtually. And if the one benefit we've definitely seen in the schools context over the last year, from my perspective, is that however good a school is at virtually engaging with its stakeholders, it will never replace the immediacy of face-to-face interaction in the classroom. And that's a great lesson to have learned and an experiment to have undertaken with probably about 1.5 billion children globally. So the data is in. We know it matters.
Now, earlier this year, you were visiting Australia and I attended a talk you were giving. And in the answer to a question, perhaps one of those throwaway responses that you were first inspired to, but you made the comment that made me sit bolt upright. And I thought, this man understands the importance of brand execution at a school, but from an entirely different perspective than I do. I just want to play part of that answer for our listener.
We've done large studies of parent-to-school relationships. Most schools in the context of the United Kingdom will have ascribed some kind of responsibility to a key point of contact at that school. And in primary schools, that usually is the class teacher, who sees the student more often. And in most secondary contexts, that's usually some kind of tutor, some kind of pastoral head of the student, somebody who has that key responsibility and overview of that child as they grow. And what we did was to measure the quality of relationships between that key point of contact and the home. And what we find universally is, irrespective of whether that young person has a range of people in their life for whom they consider to be important, for whom they consider to be important role models, if that key relationship between parent and the tutor
isn't functioning, even if the parent themselves has a good relationship with a maths teacher or a phys ed teacher. Irrespective of that, if that key relationship isn't working, what we notice is it becomes a key conduit for a negative perception of the school in general. And what we observed, what head teachers observed, was that tutors, whether they liked it or not, or whether they'd given them the responsibility or not, had become key brand managers for the entire school. Because as we use, and we use a range of different tools to look at parental satisfaction in school, it's a common thing to do in the United Kingdom, but we measure both ways the relationship. We don't think you can take a balanced score customer satisfaction approach to relationship measurement, because we say that the quality of our relationship isn't knowable by just one party. It's not just your view, it's my view as well. And that's what we're doing in our measurement. We're not measuring perception of each other, we're measuring something in the middle, this quality of relationship. And it is an important thing to hold, to know, to see. And when we don't see problems, we don't solve them.
So, Rob, let's dive a little bit deeper into that data. That last point that you made about it's not a classic measurement of relationship as we often would as brand marketers. You're measuring that thing in the middle, if you like, the relationship itself from both directions. But also, you know, just very quickly, the size of the data set that you're working with, because they're quite large as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's just, attack that first part and apply that thinking to organisations. We start any project with a sort of fundamental idea that any organisation, whether that be a small tech startup to a global NGO, is nothing but a highly complex network of relationships. Yeah, we have to start with that premise, and I think people would at least be on the same page of that. But the question is, what if almost all of its value is created or squandered in those relationships, in the spaces between the people? And I think in a Western world dominated by a focus on the individual, that feels quite radical, but it comes more easily to people in other cultures. So, for example, in Japan, the Japanese traditionally value the space between two structural parts as highly as the parts themselves. This concept, what they call, I think it's called ma, it influences everything from gardening to music. It's where our focus is. We're really interested in something that is being co-created by people in the middle. And there has been a necessity to both understand that through the measurement of it, to take it and harness it and hold it.
So, Rob, just to come back to this brand question, you said in that clip that tutors and primary teachers, that primary contact with the student, are de facto brand managers. Now, you said that without prompting. So what made you think of it in brand terms? How did you come to that point?
Well, in our studies, I mean, the second part of the question you asked, was about our data sets and how large they are. And they do now contain tens of thousands of students. And what that allows us to do in many instances is multivariate regression modeling. So we can both understand relationships and the key drivers of them simultaneously. Now, in the context of the question you've asked around brand management, what we understand about parental engagement or parental relationship with school in some of the studies we've undertaken, we know that schools are mediated through a range of channels, and those channels vary according to phase, age, needs, other factors. In all those contexts, however, parents will always have a key contact, which is either a class teacher, a pastoral tutor, or some form of assigned liaison officer. There is always somebody given that responsibility. Our prior research has always focused on that dyadic relationship between home and that key contact. And so what we did, we used our tools, the relational proximity framework tool, to explore the closeness of the underlying relationship in terms of our five dimensions. That's communication, time, knowledge, power, purpose. I'm sure we might go into a little more depth later in this conversation. They're what we call the domains or facets of a relationship. But we also explored how the school itself featured in the relationship as either a limiting or enabling factor and as a relational entity in and of itself. That is to say, what we were doing simultaneously was asking parents about their perception of the school and measuring the quality of relationship with that key point of contact. Now, the interesting thing about the way most schools manage that relationship is that there is an assumption that perhaps many people hold that responsibility. So, you know, particularly as a student gets older, so they will be taught by a myriad of people across a school. There'll be a number of adults mm-hmm. in their life. But when you ask the question, I mean, when fundamentally exploring the question why you should even have some kind of pastoral structure in a school, if you ask teachers their view of that, of what pastoral care is, what their responsibilities are, unsurprisingly, many fail to really pin down what that means. Those like Hamblin in 1981 were concerned about the sheer number of responsibilities required of that role and the lack of clarity around it. Teachers, when interviewed, consistently described their pastoral role with confusion and uncertainty. What Hamblin describes as something as a system with no explicit aims. But the problem is that in that world, parents rely on clean and clear communication from school. But on the other side, very few schools really have identified consistently the mechanism with which that channel is open and managed. And what we know is from those like Calvert and Henderson, a famous study in 1998, is what they say is that such systems, when they're right, they have a dramatic impact on levels of parental involvement or, to quote, contribute to major increases in levels of parental involvement. Now, fundamentally, that relies on any one individual tutor engaging with a parent with whom they already establish and have established that key relationship. But that so often isn't the case. Mm-hmm. In our studies, we received a number of sort of almost complaints from people taking part in the study. There were parents who would email us or call us who felt unable to complete the questionnaires because they'd rarely or never met the key contact, in some cases over a period of several years. And this didn't just point to an impoverished relationship, but a complete non-existent relationship. It's true to say that, as I said, as the students grow older, the tutor-student relationship becomes more significant than the tutor-parent relationship. This lack of contact would perhaps be less significant, but it's clear from the data that we took that teachers are not merely the pastoral point of contact or a focal point of academic review. They represent the principal means by which parents judge school quality. That is to say that we found consistently if a parent had a good relationship with that key point of contact, irrespective of all the other relationships in the child's or student's life, that perception of the school was strong, it was good, and it was overwhelmingly positive consistently over a period of time. And of course, that points to the need for a school and to create the space, the structure, the environment for that relationship to flourish. Because if it's dysfunctional, if the relationship is fragmented, not only does parents, carers, guardians feel differently about the school, but when things go wrong, it's very, very difficult to repair the relationship and repair the damage done to the brand. So what we're really interested in is the channel in and of itself, the breadth of it, the bandwidth of it, and the clarity of it. And the only way you can do that is to think very carefully, intentionally about the internal structures of the school that enable that relationship to flourish, if that makes sense.
You're listening to the School Marketing Journal podcast. Your hosts are Image 7 partners Brad Entwistle and Andrew Sculthorpe. For more information about the podcast or the print journal, go to image7.com.au/SMJ. If you find this podcast helpful, please help us by sharing with a colleague. Thank you. Now, back to Brad and Scully.
Now, Rob, the Image 7 working definition of a brand is who you are, what you promise, and your ability and willingness to keep that promise. Now, from your perspective and everything that you've learned, is the head of the school the promise maker and the tutor or the teacher the promise keeper in that relationship between school and home?
I don't know it's as simple and straightforward as that. I think I'd worry in that particular definition that promise making and keeping end up being selling and delivering. So I think the reality is that any principle of a
school... Well, you know us marketers, we always like to oversimplify everything.
But listen, I like the question. I think it's important for schools to wrestle with. So bear with me because I was really challenged by the question. I like it. I think principles, to my mind, need to be more deeply embedded in the life and culture of the school. The danger is that they're, and one can see why this is the case. I mean, many schools now are large businesses. Even the first school I worked in, 2,100 pupils, probably an annual turnover of 13 to 15 million pounds. That's a lot of money. So anybody running an organization that needs to understand business, but principals cannot just be glorified CEOs or marketing directors, because they're ultimately accountable for the delivery of the promise and therefore want to be part of the embedded culture. The problem is that, to my mind, promises also have roots if the brand is to be sustainable and have substance. Hence the idea, of course, of you know, the idea of brand often a story. The danger is that we've already worked out what the promise is and that the promise is consistent from school to school, of course, which it isn't. Many schools will promise different things. So for a parent sending, although I don't know that's always explicit. I think sometimes that's implicit. So some schools in which you might spend a good deal of money over a period of time to send a young person to, there might be an implicit understanding that that young person will get outstanding qualifications and will find themselves into a premier, what we might call in the UK, a red brick university, and beyond that into top level executive management, that pathway is assured and that promise is there. Whereas, of course, others may be making promises which are far more subtle. They might be promises which are more about outcomes for the individual delivered. So qualifications is one thing, but what about character development? Or can a promise be about how we will journey together? Because ultimately, outcomes in their broadest sense, success, will be a promise that all parties around the table will need to invest in and keep a part of. And that includes the students. They must be invested in it, and the parents to a certain extent, and the teachers, and the principals. So I'm not sure that I want to divide and demarcate that sort of shared goal or vision between people. I think we all have to be part of the solution. And in this instance, I think it's helpful to talk about relationships as the substance of the promise. What is it that's actually being experienced? And this helps us move from a glib, empty promise to an experienced reality. Anyway, I loved the question, Brad, and I think, I did.
What can teachers and tutors be doing to deepen that relationship? So it's been identified, you've done the work, we know that it's important and it exists, but what can they be doing to make it more effective and, in our terms, be better brand managers and be better educators as a result?
As I said earlier, I think we need to think about this as a channel that needs to be open and clear. So therefore, it's important for us to understand what we even mean by relationship. So at Relationships Foundation, we define a relationship as the connection between individuals, groups, or organizations, which are revealed in the way they talk and behave to each other. Robert Hine, the Cambridge academic, defines a relationship as a series of interactions between individuals who know each other such that each interaction can be influenced by past interactions, by interactions, or by expectations of interactions in the future. Yeah. So in our work, we say relationships, as I said before, can be understood as comprising five dimensions: directness, i.e., good quality communication, commonality, shared purpose, that is goals and vision that are shared and co-created, but they're explicitly known and bought into by both parties, continuity, that is time together and shared history. We use a word to describe that bandwidth of the relationship as multiplexity. It's a rather ugly word which speaks of the many strands of the relationship. At its heart, is an understanding that we know each other much better when we know each other in different contexts and we have lots of knowledge and differing knowledge about each other, a mutual understanding and a breadth of knowledge. So you need to work very intentionally on the context in which people know each other. If you only ever hear from a representative of the school via a pushed email, you know, CRM, then you'll never really know them as well as if you have spoken to them on the phone, been into their house, which is very common now in the UK. And my experience is education professionals first meeting parents in their home, in their context as family, because what that does, it leads to that fifth dimension, which is parity in the relationship, that is, a sense of equality in that relationship. And these can be used to describe the attributes of a relationship that need to be invested in. I think it's perhaps even more powerful to speak of those five dimensions when there is a lack of some of those things. So what we learn from contexts like our work in peace building, for example, is that lack of directness, lack of good communication equates to remoteness, that the absence of commonality equates to divergent or conflicting interests. And therefore, no one's really paid attention to making sure that we're all on the same page. Without parity, relationships are unfair or even coercive. A lack of continuity indicates that a relationship is new and uncertain. A lack of multiplexity is expressed as a one-dimensional relationship without any kind of broad understandings. So first of all, I think it's really important to say that the very best schools that I've seen internationally, where they have pastoral systems, processes, and structures that are effective and thriving, create intentional daily spaces for young people and that key point of contact to be together. In the very best examples, at least 45 minutes a day that are explicitly planned for as well. Not just time in one space, but something which has been really thought through and has almost a curriculum and life of its own. And secondly, as I started to allude to in the first part of that answer, that when we start to communicate with parents and engage with them, so we must think really creatively about the context we provide for that dialogue, which has to be done in multiple and varied ways in different contexts and across the year so that there is momentum built through that relationship. If you've only planned one type of communication with parents, or you're only going to meet them once or twice in a year and it's for 10 minutes, and it's really a one-way dialogue in which a teacher explains to a group of parents how things are going, yeah, then that band, that channel will always be narrow and the relationship will always be vulnerable as a result.
Now taking this back to our listeners, school heads, how can they better lead their teaching staff to understand this role of relationship? How can they nurture it with their staff? Or even, can you do professional development for it? Can you train for it?
That's a great question. I think what we've learned from our large data sets are some important structural questions. That is to say that if the environment isn't conducive for relationship building, irrespective of what happens on the individual level, those relationships will always be threatened. And that is to say, for example, that what we notice in weak interactions between students and teachers in classrooms, it's usually probably a factor of school size, then a factor of class size, and sometimes a factor of makeup of class. So what we know, for example, from our social network mapping of just student interactions in class is that if a young person is going to be or more likely to be isolated, fragmented from their peer group, they're probably an individual in Australia who has joined the school midway through the life of that school or that year, is from a different culture or tradition to the dominant within that class, probably with English as an additional language, probably somebody who is not as academically strong as the peer group, but fundamentally somebody who lives probably a postcode or more away, who doesn't live in the close community. And so what we notice is that if those things aren't paid attention to start with, if somebody hasn't thought deliberately about the structure and makeup of classes, and they haven't thought deliberately about their onboarding process of the way in which students come into a school, and particularly if they join halfway through the year, then that relationship is already threatened. And then you ask the question around relational capability and capacity of a teacher to learn and develop these skills. Well, it is definitely true to say, you know, there's such a danger that this becomes a conversation around personality type, whether it's around introversion, extroversion, all those kinds of things, which in our experience is not the case. But it is true to say that there are certain types of behaviors or approaches which will definitely undermine the relationship in a given moment. And these things can be learned, they can be invested in. So it does point to two things principals ought to be doing. And we've got a massive bank of resources on our website that people can explore to try and learn more about this. Whole books about being a relational teacher and relational teaching, and that we can point people to. But ultimately, it's fundamentally two important important things. One is around the systems and processes and structures of a school, which both, as I said, create the environment where relationships can grow and the space in which they can develop. And we need to be really intentional about the time for relationship. We often refer to in our world as time as the currency of relationship. And we very rarely spend enough time together in order to build meaningful relationship. And secondly, there's a conversation in dialogue, a language around professional development and learning. Can you develop, you know, skills of relational teaching? Undoubtedly. Since I've been working here for the last 3 years, we've got examples of schools all over Australia where individuals and groups have now set about a 10-week program of professional learning with teachers, you know, taking our materials, changing classroom practice and speaking really positively about changes to the environment and the feeling of relationship. If you're thinking particularly about this, you know, the issue of parental engagement or those channels, then again, we've got whole reports and findings that can be unpacked and explored with some key lessons for that. But yeah, there's a lot that can be done intentionally by principals to address this.
So just before we close off, where can listeners learn more about Relationships Foundation and access some of those resources?
The best place to go for the school's work is our website, www.relationalschools.org. That's where we have a number of key artifacts there, research reports, books, and films. I used to teach film media studies, so I've made a lot of documentary film. So we often like to give voice to our research participants through that mechanism. Or just for the wider theory and perhaps interest in some of our work across peace and business and healthcare, go to relationshipsfoundation.org and you'll find more about our particular analytical tools and approaches there.
So, and I can say the documentaries are really good. They are worth watching.
Thank you.
So those websites again, relationalschools.org and relationshipsfoundation.org. Rob, thanks for joining us on the School Marketing Journal podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, as always, let us know your thoughts, questions and suggestions with an email to smj@image7.com.au. And just a couple of quick reminders, the School Marketing Journal podcast is the sibling of the School Marketing Journal in print, which is created and distributed to independent school heads across Australia by Image 7. If you're not receiving yours, drop us an email to smj@image7.com.au. and apply to receive your complimentary edition. And if you're listening from the Image 7 website or on Spotify or some other wonderful place on the internet, why not subscribe to your favourite podcast player and get your dose of modern school marketing insight delivered straight to your device? Even better, you can give us a review, but even better than that is simply tell a colleague. Next week, I'll be back with Scully. Until then, remember, it's your mission. It's your brand. Do it well.
Thank you for listening to the School Marketing Journal podcast with Brad Entwistle and Andrew Sculthorpe. This podcast and the School Marketing Journal in print are powered by the team at Image 7. Subscribe and learn more at image7.com.au/smj.